This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, if you've had COVID-19, you may have some questions about natural immunity, the vaccines, and more. We'll get some answers from a Wisconsin epidemiologist. Now, President Biden pulled up to the White House yesterday in something other than the usual black limousine. That was Biden peeling out, sort of, in a plug-in hybrid Jeep Wrangler before announcing some new federal targets for electric vehicle production and emission standards. Biden had said during the presidential campaign that he intended to reverse Trump administration actions that had limited the fuel economy goals set while Barack Obama was president. You can join in at 608-890-3452. That's a temporary number, 608-890-3452. What thoughts do you have about a more electrified automotive future in this country? Do you already drive a hybrid, plug-in, or fully electric vehicle of some sort? Tell us about it. Have you considered purchasing one of those types of vehicles? Do you want to see a stronger fuel economy standards in the U.S.? Call in now at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tai is a professor of law at UW-Wisconsin Law School, focusing on environmental law, administrative law, and contracts. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
And Michelle Krebs is executive analyst with Cox Automotive. Michelle, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle, let's start with you. I want to listen to a little bit of what President Biden said yesterday, envisioning a future for the auto industry that's electric.
Battery, electric, plug-in, hybrid, electric, fuel cell electric. It's electric, and there's no turning back. The question is whether we'll lead or fall behind in the race for the future.
Michelle, what stands out to you about the goals we heard from the president yesterday?
I think first what stood out to me is we've not set a goal before. So this is the first time we have set a goal. President Biden has targeted, and that's not a binding thing, 50% of all new vehicles by 2030 will be electrified. And by that, it means pure electric vehicles. It means plug-in hybrids and fuel cell vehicles.
Steph, compared to standards in the past, if these goals are fulfilled, and we'll talk about the if part of that in a bit, how big a deal is this for overall efforts to control climate change emissions in the U.S.?
So the transportation sector is a large contributor to carbon emissions, and so this would have a very significant kind of effect. But to the extent that it's having an effect beyond what would have happened beforehand, it's less big than one might think. That is, California had already been moving in this direction, and this goal is a goal that has already been adopted by California. And that same goal, due to various aspects of federal law, can be adopted by other states. So other states were already moving in that direction. So it's not like this came out of nowhere, but it is still a significant move.
Michelle, I've heard from some analysts, maybe from you in the past, that, you know, what the United States does may not matter so much anymore if, say, European demand for lower emissions vehicles is going up. And if China is trying to take the lead on it, how big a deal is it to see these kind of priorities in the U.S. in particular?
Oh, I think it's extremely important. China is the biggest EV market in the world and the biggest car market. But, you know, we're not far behind, and Europe is another big market. So, you know, it's got to be the big markets that take the lead. And frankly, the U.S. has been lagging, right? I think President Biden made a remark about, you know, China's got leadership right now, and we don't want them to have leadership.
And Steph, can you talk about the kind of zigzag we've seen in the U.S. as we change from Republican to Democrat to back in the White House?
Yeah, so, I mean, we saw how the Trump administration, and actually, so the Biden administration goals were similar, but are actually stronger than some of the sort of Obama administration goals. However, when going from Obama to Trump, the Trump administration removed a lot of these sort of Obama administration goals. So this is putting in place sort of a stronger kind of goal. So you see this sort of up and down. At the same time, you see this overlay of what states were doing, because when the Trump administration removed some of these emission standards and backed off from the Obama administration emission standards. Some of the states, such as California that I mentioned before, started stepping in. And these were large market states. So when they were stepping in, there was additional leverage being created, not from the federal government, but from sort of various state governments.
Talking to Steph Tighe from UW-Wisconsin Law School and Michelle Krebs with Cox Automotive, looking at yesterday's announcement from the Biden administration aiming to boost production of electric vehicles and related infrastructure in the United States. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Let's go to your calls now. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking the call. So I'm all for electrification. My big concern is, as a farmer and a diesel technician, I work two different occupations. We dealt with this with John Deere for a long time. They have proprietary authority over a lot of their software and any type of ability for independent repair facilities to work on their equipment. So I'm trying to figure out, and I work on Freightliner, Peterbilt, Kenworth, Volvo, all those different trucks. Now, for Volvo, for instance, you can't change the turbo on their trucks without having the computer actuation ability to recalibrate the wastegate on the turbo actuator. So you could change the turbo, but you couldn't make the truck run without their software.
Oh, and thanks for the call. Your line's a little muffled. I don't know if you heard it, but Michelle, bring up the point of repairing these electric vehicles on the market. That's one of the questions about the infrastructure out there. Is this a concern that if we have these electric vehicles flooding the market, that they may be a challenge for the repair business and folks like Owen?
Certainly. And that's going to require a lot of retraining of automotive technicians. So that is a big concern. And who is going to do those repairs? Well, what happens, you know, do they go back to the dealership? How do independent repair shops deal with that? So that is yet to be worked out. And they require, you know, more expertise in software, electrical engineering than our current engines that rely more heavily on mechanical engineering.
Thanks, Owen, for that call at 608-890-3452. And yes, Steph, go ahead.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention, too, the right of repair, because on July 9th, President Biden did also sign an executive order regarding the right of repair and urging the Federal Trade Commission to enact regulations that would enhance the right of individuals versus the company like John Deere to be able to repair farm equipment, and not just farm equipment, but many other equipment types of equipment. And so I think these two types of efforts can work in conjunction with each other.
Thanks again for that call, Owen. And Michelle, with infrastructure, of course, there's the charging infrastructure. Where are you going to fill your electrical tank, if I can mix a metaphor there? What did the Biden administration have to say to tell people that, yeah, if you drive these things across the country, you're going to be able to charge them?
Well, this is going to be the number one challenge for EV adoption. And when we do surveys of consumers, that is, besides cost, that is their biggest concern. We have this infrastructure bill, the bipartisan Senate bill, that actually halved the amount of money that the Biden administration wanted for EV charging infrastructure. So that is going to be a big challenge if we're going to have this many EVs on the road. So we're going to have to figure that out, because infrastructure is absolutely critical to adoption of EVs.
And Steph, I know people have raised the concern, like, okay, yeah, it's electricity, but you have to generate the electricity somehow. Does going from an internal combustion engine to partial or fully electric have a big environmental impact?
Yeah, and that is very dependent on the source of electrical energy in whatever area that you're charging your vehicle. That is, and I tell my students this all the time, electric vehicles, great and all, if you are in a state with many renewables, right? If it's mostly renewables that are contributing to the electric grid, then that's fine. You're moving to a renewable energy source. But if the state is pretty much entirely coal-fired, then you haven't made as much of a change as you might think. So this has to be done in conjunction with a lot of other types of efforts.
We're talking about new federal targets for electric vehicle sales and auto emission standards President Biden announced yesterday. Our guests are UW-Madison law professor Steph Tai and Cox Automotive executive analyst Michelle Krebs. And you can join in at 608-890-3452. What are some hurdles you worry about when you think about a fully or partially electric vehicle? What things would help solve those problems for you? What would help attract you to that? Do you want to see this be a priority from the federal government, from automakers? Call 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with automotive analyst Michelle Krebs and law professor Steph Tai looking at new proposed electric vehicle sales and emission standards we heard from the White House yesterday. You can call in with your thoughts, experiences maybe, or your questions at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now with Philothea in Viroqua. Philothea, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've had two electric vehicles, one a Nissan Leaf, which was all electric, and I opted to go for a plug-in hybrid, and I'm driving a Chevy Volt right now. And I just wanted to make some comparisons and some obstacles I've run into.
Go for it.
For one thing, I found out now that not all the charging stations are going to be compatible with all the electric vehicles. And I feel like that's really, really important. So my Volt was compatible with my charging station at home for my Nissan Leaf. But I understand it won't be compatible for a Tesla, you know, charging stations. And I think that's a problem. Also, I think that the plug-in hybrid is really the best, because unless you have charging stations every 10 miles and many charging stations in each town and hundreds in cities, I mean, it needs a huge infrastructure. And I have run out of range and been stuck someplace where I couldn't plug in anywhere. So those are some of my concerns.
Philothea, thanks a lot for sharing that firsthand experience. Michelle, these are problems that still need solving. Is that right?
Yes. Range anxiety is real. And she actually experienced something more than anxiety,
right.
Actuality. And I don't know where she comes from. And, you know, plug-in hybrids are probably a good bridge for people who don't have access to charging infrastructure. On the charging infrastructure, in terms, yes, Tesla has its own design. The company has said it's going to open that up to be compatible with others, as I understand it, but that hasn't happened yet. But that is a hurdle we need to overcome, is to have charging stations that accommodate everyone, that are maintained, they're always working. There are a lot of things we need to do about the way we design them.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Philothea. Steph, I've seen some reaction from environmental groups who were hoping the White House was going to go further on more mandatory standards in particular, as opposed to some of the voluntary components. Where do you see this falling short in any way?
Yeah, so there isn't anything mandatory in here. There is a call, however, for both the EPA and the Department of Transportation to start work on what's called rulemakings, to make things to create standards that might be more mandatory. Now, it's just a call, they say, as appropriate and consistent with applicable law, which these agencies may ignore, but it is a push for these agencies to create what's called administrative rules, which is basically giving the sort of force of law to particular types of standards. So this could happen. We don't see this directly in the executive order, but it provides the opportunity to do so. And it makes sense in a way that these types of details are not contained in the executive order because these types of rules can be challenged quite easily. That is, one of the things I teach is administrative law, and it's the standards where agencies have to pass particular rules. And without doing this background work, without providing scientific justification, economic justification, whatever, these rules can get overturned. So in a way, it makes sense that the executive order doesn't contain all that. But by directing them to start work on this, it at least starts the ball rolling on these rules, should the agencies move forward with that.
Let's go back to our callers now with Jack on the line in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Jack?
So I just wanted to say, as nice as it would have been, like, had this happened maybe sometime in the past decade, I am really glad that the president is taking this opportunity to invest in electric vehicles, to spread the message of EVs, and to get people talking about it, if nothing else. And then hopefully, at least when people are thinking of buying their next car, they will go with a Tesla Model 3 or a Nissan Leaf or whatever the newest and coolest vehicle is that car owners are looking at. So I'm just really glad this is happening now, even if it's like maybe 5 to 10 years in the making, depending on when the first EVs hit the market early on. But this is terrific, and I'm really glad this is happening now.
And do you have one of these yourself, Jack?
Yes, my parents happen to own a Tesla Model 3, and I'm looking to one-up them with the Model S.
Jack, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Michelle, among consumers, are we getting to a tipping point with more people like Jack jumping on the bandwagon, in this case that his parents started?
I wouldn't say that we're at a tipping point, but we certainly are. When we interview people on our surveys, we definitely are seeing them say that they are more willing to consider an EV. EV sales, while they're still very small, this last quarter they increased 255%. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are more choices out there, and there are becoming some more, you know, not everybody can afford a Tesla. And so we're starting to see vehicles from Ford and Volkswagen and Chevy are a little bit more affordable. And affordability is a big challenge. And that's one that concerns me a lot going forward.
Jack, thanks for that call. We're talking to Michelle Krebs with Cox Automotive and Steph Tai, professor at UW-Madison Law School, about electric vehicles. A big announcement from the Biden administration, setting goals anyway for more electric and hybrid vehicles on the road. Back to your calls now. John is on the road on the way to Door County. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. What do you want to bring up, John?
Well, you know, you guys brought it up a little bit earlier about where do you get the electricity? Now, you talked about coal, and nuclear wasn't brought up. And I think the coal industry has their emissions pretty much under control, federal government control, and nuclear too. But what happens to nuclear waste? Now, I'm all for electric vehicles. I'm an old hot rodder from the old days, but I'm all for electric vehicles. But what really concerns me is, are we going from the fire into the frying pan with as far as
I gotcha, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Steph, I know coal use has been way down, natural gas way up, renewables going up. How about the nuclear that John had mentioned there?
Nuclear is remaining fairly static. It's been around like 10%. This sort of share the electric generating capacity. And a lot of it is kind of dependent on sort of siting and stuff like that. So less dependent on... So here's the thing. So with siting and getting permits for a nuclear facility, there's a lot of hurdles to go through. And those hurdles include both federal law and some state law kind of aspects. And that's the main barrier to the sort of proliferation to nuclear energy. And that hasn't changed a lot. So I don't expect to see the growth of that. Although, again, the Biden administration could do some tipping point, but I haven't seen any kind of sense that they're going to interfere too much with either increasing nuclear energy or decreasing nuclear energy. So I expect that most of the changes will be in coal-fired versus renewables versus maybe natural gas.
J- John, thanks for the call. That reminds me, Michelle, we've been talking about how we generate the energy. How about storage and batteries? This was part of the Biden administration announcement yesterday, hoping to boost the battery production here in the U.S. instead of relying on places like China. What are the hurdles we'd have to overcome in the auto industry to get those batteries?
Well, those are big ones. So we have to build more plants that make batteries, and we have to find minerals like cobalt, for instance, lithium, that are mined in an ethical, sustainable way and processed maybe here. We don't do that. And so that is an important thing. A lot of those minerals are in places where they use child labor, for instance, and we need to pay attention to that. So that is part of the infrastructure we need to build to build the batteries, to build the electric vehicles, and preferably here. You know, there's been a big computer chip shortage in the auto industry, and I think that's been an eye-opener to the industry and to the government that we are too dependent for those kinds of things on Asia.
And Steph, just in our last minute, you mentioned transportation, the leading climate change emitter in the U.S., but not the only one, and only a little over a quarter, I think. Is there other low-hanging fruit in our last minute that we might see the Biden administration looking at?
Yeah, I mean, part of the infrastructure part is also something to focus on. So, you know, buildings are not necessarily very efficient, which means that we could get a lot more efficiency out of heating, cooling, et cetera. That's an area where we expend a lot more energy, thus increasing carbon emissions. Another one is electricity generation. Well, another one is in agricultural production. There's both opportunities for carbon sequestration in the soil in terms of reducing carbon emissions, but then there's also waste in terms of energy expenditures that we might not have to put into agriculture. So there's a lot of different areas that we could be focusing on, and it seems like we're working on all of them as we can.
We'll leave it there. Steph, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Steph Tai is a professor at the UW-Madison School of Law. Michelle Krebs is an executive analyst with Cox Automotive. We talked with them today about new White House goals for electric vehicle sales, fuel efficiency, and emissions. On Central Time, we've talked a lot about the coronavirus, what the evolving research tells us about it, and how to protect yourself from it. What if you've already had COVID-19? Are there special considerations, maybe specific research you need to know about? We're focusing on those questions and talking about what we know about things like natural immunity and what the Delta variant means for those who've already had COVID-19. You can join in at 608-890-3452. Have you had COVID-19, or maybe someone in your family has? What questions do you have about natural immunity? What about the risk of reinfection? Did you get vaccinated after having had the illness yourself? Are you having a hard time finding answers? And what about long COVID? Have you felt long-term impacts? Call 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences and director of the Master of Public Health program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Nice to be here.
Well, two key words in this conversation are antibodies and then the phrase natural immunity. Can you talk about what those mean and how they fit together?
Yeah, so natural immunity occurs when you've had an infection and you've survived it. Your immune system during that period of fighting the infection builds an immune response, and antibodies are one of the tools that your body has to fight infection with the same germ that you experienced illness for. Antibodies come in all different types. There are a particular type of antibody called a neutralizing antibody that will essentially block a pathogen from eliciting disease down the line if you were to become re-exposed to that germ. And those are the kinds of things we want vaccination to elicit, a neutralizing antibody that'll help people be protected from getting disease.
And this can vary, right, from one disease to another. So one disease you might get and have a really long period of immunity, another disease that might fizzle relatively quickly. Is that right?
That's right. For some diseases, we don't develop really any immunity, and you can get infected again in the future. And for others, you get a lifelong immunity.
When it comes to COVID-19, we're still early in the game here in a lot of ways when it comes to the impacts of both natural immunity and vaccines. What, so far as you're seeing it, do we know about how long-lasting natural immunity is for people who have been through and survived COVID-19?
When people have had COVID before, you do get some immunity. And we also know this is true because reinfections are generally pretty rare for people who've had COVID before. There's a lot of laboratory-based studies to look at antibody levels in people who have had natural infection. And a broad array of antibodies are produced. In general, they're not as potent, potentially, as the antibodies that are produced when people are vaccinated. But that's not to say that they're not potent enough to protect yourself from reinfection. And we do see that reinfection overall is rare.
Now, yesterday, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky told CNN that people who have had COVID do still need to get vaccinated. And that's current CDC guideline. We have had medical professionals on our show who said, you know, looking at the studies that they're looking at, it looks like natural immunity is pretty good. They may need only one shot or maybe even no shots. These things, you know, the science is still out there. What are your thoughts on the current standards that say, hey, if you've had it, you still ought to get vaccinated?
Yeah, there's some good studies to show that after just a single dose of vaccination in someone who's previously had COVID, that dose of vaccine acts like a booster because you've got immunity from your previous infection, which you survived, and getting that dose of vaccine boosts that memory. And those people actually have higher levels of neutralizing antibodies than somebody who was vaccinated but never previously had COVID. So if I were to sort of rank order the people in our society who are going to be the most protected, I would rank vaccinated individuals who previously had COVID on the top. They probably have the lowest risk for reinfection. Then come vaccinated people who didn't previously have COVID. And then unvaccinated people who had COVID before have immunity, but it's not going to be as durable as the people who also got vaccinated.
And then, of course, the most vulnerable would still be the completely unvaccinated people who haven't had the illness. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Those are the ones who are going to be the most vulnerable and are going to continue to fuel the ongoing spread of this virus in our society.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at what the emerging science is about people who have had COVID-19 and survived when it comes to their immunity to the illness, whether they need to be vaccinated. Current guidelines say, yeah, you ought to get vaccinated even if you've had it. You can join in at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Do you have questions about this? And are we talking about you? Did you have COVID-19? Have you felt longer-term impacts from it? Did you get vaccinated in addition to having had the illness? Call in now at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay, here we are, the Delta variant. We know it spreads more quickly, for sure, among unvaccinated people. How is it changing the experience, the risk for people who have had COVID in the past?
Yeah, so it does kind of depend on when you had COVID. And if you had COVID a long time ago, of course, the immunity is going to wane a little bit the longer ago you had it. But the virus has evolved, and the Delta variant presents a different challenge for somebody who's been infected with a very different strain. You will have that memory if you were reinfected with the same strain, and you do have some protection against Delta. But this is here where the vaccines afford better protection against the Delta variant than previous natural infection. And of course, if you have both, you've got maximal protection.
Another concern for people who have had COVID is we've heard reports and concerns about longer lasting impacts of the disease, sometimes called long haul COVID. Again, still a question I think we're probably investigating now, but what do we know about the people who survive happily but are still feeling the impacts of the illness?
Yeah, some people for months and maybe longer, you know, continue to maybe have a brain fog, experience fatigue. Maybe it takes a little longer for them to regain their sense of taste and smell, or they just report being off for a longer period of time. It's not rare. I mean, there are many people who experience this, and it varies, to a great degree. And this is why it's so important to avoid infection altogether. You just don't want to be in a situation where months after recovery, you feel like you really truly haven't recovered.
Let's turn to mask wearing now for people who have had COVID, but are, especially those who are unvaccinated, but they've had the illness. What are your thoughts on when and where they need to wear masks? Any different from anybody else right now?
Well, the Delta variant is a really different animal because anybody who's carrying the Delta variant, and we know it represents 80, 90% of all infections that are out there now, being that it's the most dominant strain, people who are infected with that new variant are just so much more infectious than people who were infected with previous variants, 1,000 times greater viral load in the nasal passages of people who are carrying this virus. So mask use becomes even more important for everybody, just to reduce your risk of being exposed to that high dose of virus that's, you know, being expelled from people who have the infection. And of course, people who have the infection, if you have symptoms, you ought to be staying at home anyway and not exposing anybody at all. But we know they're spread through people who have no symptoms at all. And this is why mask use is just really critical with such an infectious virus.
How different is the Delta variant? How big a game changer is it as you see it?
Well, in terms of how highly infectious it is a completely different virus in my mind. So a complete game changer. We're comparing it to the infectiousness of chickenpox. So the original strain of SARS-CoV-2, on average, might infect 2 to 3 people. One person will pass the virus on to 2 out of 3 people during their illness. And with chickenpox, we're talking about a person spreading the virus to 9, 10, maybe 11 other people while they're ill. Because it's so infectious, it just completely overwhelms the immune system for somebody who encounters this virus. And if you're previously vaccinated, your immune system will kick in, but we're obviously hearing a lot about breakthroughs. And it's hard to know exactly how common they are. They seem to be overall pretty rare, but when they do occur, they too also have a high viral load. The Delta variant is just so much more infectious.
But as I'm hearing, Ajay, yes, we are seeing some of those so-called breakthrough cases, which we kind of knew we would with any vaccine. But when we look at the numbers when people are hospitalized and the people who are unfortunately dying of the disease, still very largely unvaccinated people. Do I have that right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's where this vaccine remains highly effective and, of course, safe for protecting against hospitalization and worse outcomes, being on a ventilator or maybe even dying from this virus. 97, 98% of people who are hospitalized with COVID now are people who are unvaccinated.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to talk about what we know about immunity and vaccines for people who have had COVID-19. You can join in. You can email if you have an experience to share, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can have a go at calling in. Looks like we've got a little glitch in our phone lines now. But you can try 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452 if you have a question or an experience to share. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now about what you need to know about immunity, the Delta variant of COVID-19, and more if you've had the illness yourself. Ajay Sethi stays with us from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And you can join in. Phone lines are working again at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Are we talking about you? Have you had the illness yourself? Did you have long-term impacts about it? Do you have questions, concerns about what long-term immunity might be for someone who's already had COVID, especially with new variants? Call in at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ajay, of course, we're having this conversation as we're seeing COVID case numbers go up in pretty much every state around the country. Big jumps in hospitalizations in particular, especially in largely unvaccinated areas. What are you watching for to see if this is just a sign of things to come or if this is going to level off in the near future?
Well, you know, in countries that experience a surge in cases due to the Delta variant, the rise was rapid and the decline was also fairly rapid, and the spike recedes generally after a few weeks. In India, which was largely unvaccinated when they had their Delta surge earlier this year, late last year, it took about 3 months for it to pass. But in the United Kingdom, it took in a matter of weeks before it receded. Here in the U.S., it probably will recede as soon as it peaks. And the question is, when is it going to peak? And that's something where I don't have that crystal ball to tell you when.
Of course. Well, let's bring on a caller now at 608-890-3452. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. A friend was fully vaccinated the first week in April. He left for vacation in June to Texas and Louisiana for a month long. Came back. He and I were going to get together in July. Had a rapid test. Came back that he was positive. He self-isolated for 2 weeks. Got retested with the standard nasal swab. The results were negative. We're wondering if the first test, the rapid test, could have been a false positive, or could he have just recovered and now his test shows that he no longer has COVID?
Christina, thanks a lot for the call and the question. Ajay, of course, you don't know the particular case here, but is this something that can happen, either a false positive initially, then a real negative test, or a real positive and you get over it and test negative a couple weeks later?
I mean, both can happen. And I'll say the fact that you have a recent test by PCR, presumably, that's negative, that's good. That means that that person is no longer positive for COVID. Whether the rapid test was false positive or a true positive, my guess is that it could be a true positive. We do have this Delta variant that's circulating, and I imagine false positives are going to be a little lower when you're talking about a virus that's fairly easy to detect because there's usually so much more viral load in somebody who's infected. But I can't say for sure what's happened here.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from JJ in Madison, who says, I'm part of a family that's fully vaccinated, and we have plans to travel internationally. We plan on wearing masks throughout our travel, whenever we're in public or indoors. The place we're going is 80% vaccinated and offers no indoor dining options. Can you please talk about your thoughts about the risks? What do you think, Ajay, based on what they gave us there? What kind of risks are there? Are there any other precautions they might take?
Well, there's no such thing as zero risk, but just by hearing the person's sort of description of what they're facing and actually paying attention to local vaccination rates and thinking about the risk, that makes me feel good that somebody who's going to take this trip with their family is maybe going to be more cautious than someone who's not paying attention to the underlying risk. And you can certainly protect yourself. Wearing a mask, keeping distance, having more of your activities outdoors. And I might also say that, you know, traveling by plane isn't necessarily higher risk because a lot of airlines are going to want proof of a negative test, maybe proof of vaccination. And so people who you're traveling with will be lower risk to begin with. I think it's also a good opportunity to think about upgrading your mask. And so if you've used cloth masks, make sure that they are indeed triple layered, got some filtration, no vents. But me personally, I've upgraded to a KN95 when I'm in situations where I think could be higher risk, and make sure that I bought a KN95 that wasn't a knockoff, one that truly is provides the right filtration.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi.
Hi. A quick question. I heard the doctor just mentioned that it peaked in India, but took about 3 months It peaked in England a little less time. And my question is, what is a peak? Does that mean that the virus has no more hosts? Or is it the hosts are so saturated that it can't spread itself around anymore?
Thanks for the question. So, Ajay, the peak I think you're referring to is, I mean, we literally saw the numbers going down. But what can lead to the numbers hitting that peak and then going back down?
Yeah, a combination of a lot of things will cause the spread of any virus to start to decline. And in this case, with the Delta variant, there's so much more that we need to learn to understand why it comes and goes, or why it has come and gone fairly quickly in the countries that have experienced it. Certainly, immunity that people develop after getting infection is a big part of it. It contributes to that so-called mysterious herd immunity that we've been all talking about that is obviously very elusive. But having people experience the infection, develop immunity that protects them from reinfection and maybe spreading it is certainly going to play a role. Behavior is also going to play a role, because when we have something catastrophic happening in our community, everybody is aware that it's really necessary to take precautions, and good behaviors and precaution taking kick in as a society, and that also reduces the spread. So in this case, a combination of both is likely to be contributing to why you see this receding. It also could be due to complex dynamics of the virus, and we just don't know those yet because the Delta variant is pretty new.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ajay, it feels like it's been forever, but this is still, in human terms, a fairly new illness. What are the big unanswered questions in your mind at this point?
Well, I think one big question that's on everybody's mind is how long will immunity last for people who are vaccinated, and of course for people who had natural infection. With time, you know, we'll find out if the rate of reinfection begins to increase. We'll have to understand why that is, and if there's a need for an updated vaccine or booster, then there are, you know, manufacturers, the government's ready for maybe that to happen. For now, that does not seem to be the case, but everybody's kind of waiting to see.
And just briefly, I think I've asked you about this before. At this point, what lessons are you hoping we take home for, hopefully in a long time, the next potential pandemic?
Well, I'll say that when we act collectively, you know, with good policy, good behavior, and just sort of a good understanding of what we're facing, when that happens, we can control pandemics. And when there's disagreement or discord or maybe a lot of misinformation out there, as a result, you know, our society is unable to control a pandemic. And we've seen that throughout this last 18 months.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ajay Sethi. He's an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to break down what you need to know about staying safe if you've had COVID-19 yourself in the past. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, the head of Wisconsin's Department of Corrections joins the show for a look at the future of the state's prison system and what the COVID pandemic has changed over the last year and a half. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about hate crime laws after a hate crime charge filed against a lacrosse man earlier this week. And remember, today was Food Friday, and we've got recipes for you. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Our guest this week focuses on using grains that might be off the beaten path for a lot of us. Well, I'll speak for myself. For me, buckwheat and barley and cornmeal and oats and sorghum and lots more. You can check out some recipes that you can bake over the weekend at WPR.org/Food Friday. A chocolate chip cookie to start things off. That sounds pretty good. Cheese and cornmeal biscuits, too, while you're there. Check them out and let us know what you think. That's at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.